Every translator the team hired, Konibu told them how it happened. "I'm alone now, with no brothers," Konibu said. "The white men killed all of my friends. Pow, pow, pow!" He chopped a hand through the air, imitating a gun. "They killed them with guns, not bows and arrows. I am alone, which is why I have this fear of the people who live over there. That's why I ran away from them." Konibu paused for a moment to clarify a point with the translator. "This guy here, and this one," he gestured to Altair and Vincent. "I'm not scared of them. I'm afraid of the white men out there." He made a sweeping gesture, as if to indicate that "out there" meant beyond the forest, to the ranches that were cutting into the other side. The translator pressed for more details, but Konibu said he needed to lie down. He withdrew into his hut and stretched out in his hammock. Altair and Vincent accompanied the translator into the hut and sat on the ground, which was soft and powdery from the ash of a dormant fire in the corner. Ururu, the elderly woman, entered and, placing both hands around her mouth, bent down to Konibu and inhaled deeply. She was sucking the poison of the bad memories out of his body, the translator explained, then blowing them to the winds. When she was finished, the translator asked if the white men had attacked the Akansu's former village during the day or at night. "They attacked during the day," Konibu said, reclining in the hammock and pointing at the ceiling. "They attacked at midday. The sun was up there. They had come with their noisy machines. Later, I only found dead bodies. But I never found the body of my brother. I don't know if maybe they had taken the body to eat it." The translator's face broke into a smile when Konibu offered the speculation, but the smile dissolved as the Akansu chief continued to speak. "The bodies of all the women were there, and the others. I looked and looked, but I didn't find it." Altair sat at the foot of the hammock with his arms crossed over his knees, next to Vincent. Altair listened with an expression of blank horror, then asked where Konibu was when the white men attacked. "I was away, over here," he said, drawing an imaginary circle in the air, indicating a location outside of the old village. "That's how I escaped, but their bullet caught me in the arm." He pointed again to the scar on the underside of his upper arm. "After that, my arm was very hurt, very swollen." Again, Konibu assured Altair and Vincent that he bore the two of them no grudges. It was the ranchers who scared him. "When I see the white men, I am terrified. It feels like my heart is going to jump out of my chest. They had come with this machine that makes a lot of noise. Wee, wee, wee. They came down very close to the people. We were left being very afraid." From details they were able to pick up from Pupak and the rest of the tribe, Altair and Vincent determined that Konibu, Pupak, and the surviving females had been away from their village when ranch hands armed with chainsaws and guns began clearing the area. It occurred to them that perhaps the lone Indian they had been tracking had been another survivor of the same attack. Perhaps, they speculated for a moment, he even might have been the brother who Konibu presumed was dead but had never found. But the Akansu never dug holes the way the lone Indian did, and they had never heard of any Akansu member doing such a thing. The attack on them had occurred at least a decade before, and from Konibu's descriptions, the location of the former village was near the Ivipita ranch, not the Modelo. Marcelo began to suspect that when he had his first arguments with the attorney, Odair Flazino, in 1985, after he and his group of Nambiquara Indians found rifle and shotgun shells around the vestiges of a destroyed Indian village, it had been the Akansu who'd been attacked. The lone Indian, however, was almost certainly of a different tribe that had suffered a similar fate. When the team members described to Konibu the general location of the destroyed village of 14 holes they'd found, the chief said he didn't know a thing about it. They told him they were trying to make contact with the lone Indian before he met a fate similar to that of Konibu's brother and fellow tribespeople. They asked him if, like Pura and Owemoro, he and maybe a few of the Akansu women would be willing to join them on their mission. They explained to Konibu that if their group could get to the lone Indian before the ranchers did, the Indian might have a chance to survive in peace on a protected piece of land, just like the surviving members of his own tribe. The idea made good sense for a couple of reasons. Even more than the Kanoe, the Akansu seemed to resemble the lone Indian, particularly the fact that he wore no clothes. Maybe the Indian would empathize with the Akansu. At the very least, the presence of more women on one of the team's expeditions might lend a more peaceful atmosphere to any encounter to let him know they hadn't come to wage war. Altair was tasked with convincing Konibu to join them, but first he had to convince him to ride in one of the Toyotas, a prerequisite for any expedition. None of the tribe members had ever set foot in a vehicle of any kind before. When the Akansu first saw the truck, they refused to go near it. It was full of nasty spirits, they said. "Listen to its roar! Look at it shake!" But slowly, painstakingly, Altair worked to assure them it wasn't as bad as they believed. He opened the doors and walked them close to the truck, encouraging them to take a good look inside. After they gave it a once-over, Altair climbed into the seat and invited Konibu and three of the women to join him. It took almost a full afternoon of pleading. He tried everything short of falling to his knees and begging, and they eventually relented. Altair gingerly shut the doors and took a seat behind the wheel. When he turned the ignition and the engine jumped to life, the Akansu lost their nerve. Konibu and the women began banging their fists against the windows. They said the noise was making them dizzy. They wanted out. After that, Konibu categorically refused to allow any member of his tribe to accompany the contact front on an expedition. The Akansu and the Kanoe were able to live together only after years of diplomatic groundwork. Konibu believed that forcing a meeting with this Indian was only asking for trouble. He told the team members that if they wanted to find the Indian and establish a relationship like they had with the Kanoe and the Akansu, they'd have to do it without his help. Maybe Owaimoro and Pura had already forgotten how dangerous a tribe could be when pushed to its limits. But Konibu hadn't. Chapter 7. Savages. In the first half of 1997, Brazil's Environmental Protection Agency temporarily banned clear-cutting in the forest where Altair had encountered the lone Indian. The prohibition was a result of that encounter, but it was a hollow gesture. The government nailed a few signs to trees at the edge of the territory, and that was it. No one enforced the ban. The ranchers continued to cut down trees, and the contact front reported the violations, to no avail. The temporary restriction existed only on paper, not in the real world. If Marcelo and his team really wanted to protect the land where they believed the Indian was living, they first needed the Justice Ministry to officially recognize his presence. To do that, Funai needed more than a mere physical description of the man. They needed a tribal name, a language, an overview of his customs, anything to prove that he represented a culture deserving of protection. There was one way to do that. The team members needed to establish contact with the Indian. Sidney Pozuelo, the head of the Isolated Indians Division in Brasilia, encouraged the contact front to launch more expeditions, gather more evidence, and, if possible, make contact with the Indian before pistoleros or ranch hands got the chance. Throughout the second half of 1997, Marcelo and the rest of the team shouldered their packs over countless jungle trails searching for signs of human life in places where no tribes had ever been officially recorded. Each month they launched an expedition, usually 4 or 5 days long, that took them through the forests claimed by the Dalafinis and their neighbors. From the start, those explorations conformed to a predictably monotonous template. They'd find a few traces of an individual Indian's presence in the woods around the Modelo Ranch, maybe a few bent twigs and a honeycut or two in a tree, but they never laid eyes on the Indian himself. During a 4-day trek in September, they came close. Marcelo, Altair, and Pura found 10 different trees that had been tapped for honey near the banks of a narrow stream. The cuts were no more than 2 days old. In the same area, they spotted 2 spiny Jaracatia trees that had been felled no more than 2 weeks before. The trunks of those trees had been slotted and placed face down in the soil, an Indian technique to attract edible insect larvae. Nearby, they found a couple of giros, suspended platforms constructed of twigs used to roast and dry meats over a fire. On the muddy slope of another stream, they found day-old human footprints. As they inspected the prints, Altair told Marcelo that he couldn't shake the feeling that they were being watched. He said he sensed that the forest had eyes, 2 of them, and they saw everything the team was doing. Before the explorers gave up and abandoned the banks of the stream for the day, they placed a machete and one of Pura's arrows on the ground as gifts. They returned a few days later. The machete and arrow lay untouched. The hikes were becoming arduous exercises in frustration. Instead of solid evidence that could fill in the blanks of the Indian's backstory, they only uncovered more clear-cutting. In his expedition reports, Marcelo described new clearings that had bitten into the forest on the Dalafini's property. He did everything typographically possible to draw attention to his indignation, punctuating his sentences with exclamation points, capitalizing words, underlining whole passages, and they were met with silence. No fines were levied, no charges filed. The contact front so far had failed to convince the country's regulators that any of it mattered. The Indian was an abstraction, not a real person who could inspire an emotional connection. It was a significant distinction. Empathy doesn't stick to a shadow. Marcelo couldn't conceal his resentment. During the evenings after making camp for the night, he usually charted his team's course on maps and scribbled field notes. While the others collected firewood and roasted whatever meat they managed to scare up for dinner, usually wild pig, turtle, spider monkey, or fish, Marcelo poured his spleen out into his journal. To Marcelo, the Indian had become a symbol, an embattled refugee on the run from a modern world rotten with depravity. In his journal one evening in September, after he found more cutting in the forest, he wrote, "The situation of this Indian is a disgrace for Brazilian society. We could never pay the debt we owe them after decimating their entire population, and now, at this moment, we can't even guarantee the minimal conditions for survival. What greed it is that allows this barbarity and the impunity!" Marcelo believed his cause was inviolate, that the cattle ranchers were law-breaking villains who needed to be brought to justice. That sort of righteousness can rub people the wrong way, especially if those people don't share your indignation. In Rondônia, Marcelo's harsh view of ranchers and loggers wasn't enthusiastically supported by the general population, because ranchers and loggers were the general population. The members of the Contact Front could cite the latest version of the Constitution all they wanted, but it was just words on paper, like the temporary restrictions placed on logging in the Indians' forest. In his little corner of the world, it was still cowboys versus Indians, and the cowboys were the good guys. Throughout its history, Brazil has struggled to decide what role Indians should play in its national story. Official policy and public sentiment have sometimes agreed on the matter, sometimes not. In the last half of the 19th century and the first decades of the 20th, a mode of thought called positivism spread from Europe and took a strong hold on Brazil's middle class. It quickly grew into something close to a theology. One of its high priests was Cândido Rondon, the legendary explorer of the country's backwoods who founded Brazil's first Indian Protection Service, and after whom Rondônia has been named. According to the positivists, cultures evolved in specific stages, from primitive to mature societies. The native tribes of Amazonia represented the very first stage of cultural evolution, one marked by animism, or the belief that any natural object can have a spirit. The positivists believed that those tribes were incapable of rational thought. But from that stage of cultural primitivism, the positivists believed the tribes could evolve through more advanced stages of development, from animism to polytheism, then to monotheism, and finally to enlightened rationalism. Rondon believed that, with help, the Indians might be able to skip the middle stages of development and leap straight into the light of modernity. He instructed agents in the Indian Protection Service that pacifying Indians helped preserve the possibility of their successful transition to modernity. He came up with a motto intended to guide agents on their pacifying missions: "Die if you must, but never kill." After he left the White House, U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt journeyed through the Amazon with Rondon in 1914 and observed the effect of positivism among Brazil's tribes was often religious conversion, an outcome the positivists never sought, but one that seemed to please the former American president. It may seem strange that among the first fruits of the efforts of a positivist should be the conversion of those he seeks to benefit to Christianity, Roosevelt wrote after his expedition with Rondon. But in South America, Christianity is at least as much a status as a theology. It represents the indispensable first step upward from savagery. In the wilder and poorer districts, men are divided into the two great classes of Christians and Indians. When an Indian becomes a Christian, he is accepted into and becomes wholly absorbed or partly assimilated by the crude and simple neighboring civilization, and then he moves up or down like anyone else among his fellows. Positivism's influence faded in the 1930s, at about the same time the idea of cultural relativism began gathering force in anthropological circles. Anthropologists began putting words such as primitive and savage inside quotation marks, arguing that they were loaded terms unfairly applied by Europeans to indigenous societies. The influence of the idea was transformative, but mostly academic. The intellectual theories that began to permeate popular thought outside of anthropological circles, theories including Freud's and Jung's, reinforced the idea that indigenous cultures represented a childlike stage of human development. Freud suggested that primitive Indians have a mentality roughly equal to that of a civilized child. Jean Piaget, a Swiss philosopher whose theories of cognitive development held wide sway over the fields of education and morality, wrote that members of many traditional indigenous cultures were, like very young children, incapable of distinguishing objective reality from their own subjectivity. The notion of native as child thoroughly infiltrated Brazil and guided its policies. In the country's Civil Code of 1916, Indians were defined as relatively capable persons and granted the same legal status as minors and the mentally deficient. That status remained even after the country enacted the Indian Statute of 1973, which stipulated that Indians needed to live as wards of the state, in the form of funai. In his 1988 book, The Indians and Brazil, Brazilian anthropologist Mércio Pereira Gomes summed up the result of the philosophies that, over decades, had combined to form the shifting backbone of the country's Indian policy. All things considered, the Indian has become a kind of bastard child of our civilization. Furthermore, an ill bastard child, for he is seen as suffering from a terminal disease inexorably condemned to death. The state's social and humanist, if not Christian, duty, then, would be to ease the sufferings of these people and ensure that they meet death with dignity. Marcello hated the Indian as child concept. He subscribed to cultural relativism's notion that his own culture was simply different, not better or worse, than the Indians. But as the local Funai representative, it was Marcello's job to serve as their guardian. Because he was philosophically opposed to that notion, his job was riddled with paradoxes. He believed the Indians had a right to political autonomy. If some Indians wanted to cut themselves off from the rest of society, and others wanted to fully integrate their tribes into the modern world, so be it. But Marcello believed they should have the freedom to make the choice. Their cultures had the right to succeed, or fail, without interference from people like him. But unfortunately, the intrusion of modern society had already started, and Indian villages were literally being bulldozed in the process. Without people like him, the Indian cultures would never get the chance to exercise those rights. The job of the contact front, particularly as it related to the lone Indian, was itself a paradox. They needed to contact the isolated Indian so he'd have the right to be left alone. By the time the contact front began searching for the Indian, Brazilian law had begun to dovetail with Marcello's view that Indian cultures had an unalienable right to survive. Just months before Marcello and Altair started on the lone Indian's trail, a jury in Rondônia found a man guilty of genocide against an Indian tribe, the first verdict of its kind in Brazil's history. The judgment was a long time coming. The guilty man, a rubber tapper accused of killing Oroween Indians and setting fire to their village, was handed his sentence more than 30 years after committing the crime. A few months later, another court brought genocide charges against men accused of attacking members of the Yanomami tribe. Those verdicts illustrated how radically the legal views of Indians had changed in a single generation. In 1969, when Marcello was in college, Brazil's permanent representative to the United Nations had argued that violence against Amazonian tribes didn't qualify as genocide if it was perpetrated for economic reasons, such as taking over their land. But after years of debate, now Brazil's courts and constitution had begun to place a higher value on indigenous cultures. Unfortunately for Marcello, the respect for individual cultures hadn't filtered down from high court rulings to much of the rest of the population. Even those who occupied positions of power seemed out of step with the courts. By the 1990s, it had become politically incorrect to publicly label Indians as hopelessly primitive savages who stood in the way of Brazil's manifest destiny. But every now and then, a federal official indiscreetly mapped the distance between the country's constitution and his own views. Prominent sociologist Elio Jaguaribe, upon being named a Brazilian cabinet minister in 1992, told reporters that Brazil needed to get out of the swamp of underdevelopment and backwardness, or we will confront a social convulsion difficult to calculate. 2 years later, he took the idea further when he defined what role Brazil's Indians would play in the country's leap to a more advanced stage of development. No role whatsoever. There will be no more Indians in the 21st century, Jaguaribe said during a seminar. The idea of congealing man in the primeval state of his evolution is, in fact, cruel and hypocritical. Disentangling Amazonian Indian tribes from the stereotypical naked savages depicted in old dime store novels is sometimes easier done from a distance than up close. Such clichés are often strongest in the areas where people live closest to the tribes, where some of the locals have seen for themselves that real tribes occasionally do partake in activities that seem brutal and fierce. The members of the Contact Front knew this better than most. They also knew that such examples didn't define tribal life any more or any less than a savage crime in a city such as Sao Paulo defined Brazil's non-indigenous culture. But occasional examples of indigenous violence remained a fact of life, and they helped explain why Rondônia's general population often found it difficult to view tribal cultures as anything other than primeval, anarchic, and menacing. One afternoon in 1997, Altair was staying in the Rio Omere camp when Pura's cousin, Owai Moro, passed through. She was walking from the Kanoe village toward the Akonsu village to collect bananas from a cluster of trees that grew there. The next morning at 7 o'clock, when Altair radioed Marcelo to transmit his daily update, he mentioned that he'd seen Owai Moro depart for the Akonsu village, but never saw her return. The two tribes had been friendly, but a member of the Kanoe tribe would never spend the night in the Akonsu village. It simply wasn't done. Later that morning, Pura arrived at the Funai base, visibly upset. Owai Moro still hadn't returned. She had left her monkey at home, which suggested that she hadn't intended to be gone so long. Pura feared that something terrible had happened. They all knew that Owai Moro had a knack for rubbing the Akonsu the wrong way. She was strong-headed, and she was convinced that the Kanoe tribe was superior to the Akonsu. Altair, Pura, and a Funai assistant set off from camp in the morning along Owai Moro's likely route toward the banana grove. After about 2 miles of hiking, they arrived in a cornfield near the Akonsu village. There they spotted a basket lying on the ground, upturned. Bananas and papayas spilled out of it. Pura recognized the basket as Owai Moro's. At the edge of the cornfield, they saw tracks leading toward the Akonsu village. As they approached the village, they saw smoke rising from the general direction of the tribe's huts. They reached the village and discovered that 4 of the tribe's 5 huts, all of them except Konibu's, had been set on fire. The fires had stopped burning, but plumes of smoke continued to rise weakly from each of them. They scanned the village grounds for clues that might tell them what happened. It was a scattered mess. Trash was strewn across the ground. Some of the Akonsu's things had been left in the huts, though most had been removed. In the middle of the clearing, they found that the dirt had been stained with what looked like gallons of dark paint. It was blood. Pura froze. His eyes began to fill with tears. Altair noticed a thin trail of blood leading to the periphery of the village clearing. It disappeared into a small patch of secondary forest that had grown over a garden plot that had been abandoned by the Akonsu years before. He and the assistant followed the trail while Pura stayed behind in the village. Several yards into the thick brush, they found Owai Moro's body. She had been hacked to death with a machete. Deep wounds slashed across her neck, her arms, her legs. When Altair reemerged into the clearing, Pura searched his face. "Owai Moro?" he asked. Altair nodded, yes, and Pura wept. The Akonsu had killed her. As tribal custom dictated, they had abandoned their own camp after taking another person's life and set fire to it, an attempt to cleanse the grounds of lingering evil spirits. They had collected most of their things and begun to build a new village a couple of miles away. Altair could only guess at the Akonsu's motives. Afterward, when he managed to speak with Konibu and the rest of the Akonsu, the tribe acknowledged the act, but refused to talk about it in detail. Eventually, Konibu blamed Pupak, the tribe's only other male. Altair's best guess was that Oemoru's bossy condescension toward the Akonsu had finally pushed Pupak over the edge, but that would always remain a guess. The day they discovered Owai Moro's body, Altair and Pura returned to the Funai camp, and Altair radioed Marcelo to tell him what had happened. Altair then accompanied Purah to the Kanoe camp to break the news to the rest of his tribe. The Kanoe were devastated. Purah and his mother gathered all of Owaimoro's belongings into baskets and began a funereal trek through the forest, back to the place where she had died. They retrieved Owaimoro's body from where it lay and dragged it back to the only one of the Akansu's huts that hadn't been burned down. They placed her body inside the hut and all of her belongings alongside her. They planned to cremate her body. Before setting the hut on fire, Purah led Owaimoro's monkey to the edge of the encampment. With a wooden club, he beat the animal to death. Then he carried its remains to the hut. He laid the monkey alongside Owaimoro and set fire to the hut. Sacrificing the monkey was a final act of love toward his cousin. He wanted Owaimoro's most cherished companion to accompany her. In death, as in life, they would remain together. Chapter 8. Letting Go. Down to four survivors, the Kanoe village was enshrouded in quietude. Living under a legacy of both slaughter and suicide, the Kanoe always had been prone to long silences. But in the months following Owaimoro's killing, those silences seemed less reflective than lugubrious. The Akansu had abandoned their charred village and built a new one a short trek away, but the fragile scaffold that had supported relations between the two tribes had collapsed. Just 2 years after the two tribes had begun to emerge from their extreme isolation by reaching out to the contact front, loneliness again began to constrict around them. Without the social interaction between the tribes, the members of the contact front remained the only human links to the world outside each of the tribe's own thatch huts. Purah sometimes visited the Rio Omere encampment, sat outside one of the Funai huts, and cried. The language barrier that separated him from the Funai workers left the finer points of his grief unexpressed. The members of the contact front stayed out of the conflict between the Kanoe and the Akansu, but some of them couldn't help feeling a little guilty. There was no getting around the fact that the team's actions, the initial contact, the establishment of the Rio Omere camp, had helped bring the two tribes together, maybe too fast. They had encouraged the alliance between the tribes and had compressed the rhythms of tribal interplay. But even if Funai had unintentionally contributed to that conflict, its employees decided that taking an active role in the resolution of the killing might compound the problem. They believed that the tribes themselves should decide how to handle it, and each tribe independently decided that a cooling period was the wisest course of action. They indefinitely suspended relations. The Akansu retreated from Funai, folding into themselves at their new village. But the Kanoe continued to look to the contact front for companionship. If anything, the personal connection between the team members and the Indians strengthened after Owaimoro's death. Purah had seen the grisly consequences of reaching out to another tribe, but it didn't stop him from volunteering to accompany the team as they prepared for another expedition on the trail of the lone Indian on August 1, 1998. It wasn't perfectly clear why Purah wanted to go. It never really had been. He had always been mildly curious about the Indians' way of life, but he didn't seem particularly interested in the possibility of getting to know the man. When Altair repeated the story of his single encounter with the lone Indian outside his thatch hut, Purah would smile and shrug, as if to say he thought Altair was a little crazy to approach an unknown Indian. So when Altair pondered what might lie behind Purah's enthusiasm to join the expedition, he thought it had something to do with camaraderie, or maybe the simple thrill of exploring new places. Often Purah would return from those trips with a basket full of supplies, such as pieces of taquara palm that could be used for arrow tips, or strange feathers, or rare fruits that weren't so easy to find near the Kanoe village. Whether they found the Indian seemed beside the point to Pura. It was the journey that seemed to interest him, not the intended destination. By the beginning of 1998, the team had uncovered more evidence that the Indian was on the run. He seemed to be keeping one step ahead of the ranchers who continued to cut the forested sections of their properties. In the second half of 1997 and the early part of 1998, Marcelo and Altair found several additional huts that the Indian had abandoned as loggers cleared more of the forest around the Modelo Ranch. Some of his huts appeared to have been constructed in a day, then abandoned almost as quickly. During one expedition, in June 1998, they found two huts. The location of those huts suggested he was moving over the property lines, reacting to the movement of the loggers. Sometimes he remained inside the Dalafini's property, sometimes he crossed into forests claimed by other ranchers. In July 1998, workers on Jaime Bagatoli's property, which included the forest where they had found the first hut 2 years earlier, had told them they'd seen the Indian again, though he'd disappeared almost instantly. The language in Marcelo's memos to Funai's headquarters throughout 1998 took on a new tenor of urgency, one that at times bordered on desperation. So far, the agency's official response had been one of wait and see. Marcelo tried to tell them that if they waited much longer, they'd see a tragedy unfold right before their eyes. "The situation of the Indian is getting more complicated all the time in this atmosphere of permanent insecurity, with the frequent activity of non-Indians around his dwellings. Workers are encroaching on his huts and cutting down the wilderness where he hides, not even leaving him the minimum of tranquility to live or to hunt. The people who are expelling him are illegally destroying hundreds of hectares of native forest, either unaware of the restrictions put upon the land by regulatory agencies or else simply refusing to comply with those judicial decisions. Funai must officially recognize the Indian's existence and make policies that guarantee his right to survive where he is, at least until contact is made and other considerations can be made concerning his future. But at this moment, in such a turbulent atmosphere, that possibility grows more remote and complex all the time." Funai officials responded that their hands were tied. They couldn't officially recognize the Indian's presence until they knew more about him, a tribal name, a little backstory. They needed contact, in other words. In writing back to Funai, Marcelo made sure the bosses in Brasilia recognized that they weren't the only ones toiling in less than ideal circumstances. Tracking the Indian was like chasing a ghost. His tribal affiliation was still completely unknown. Marcelo had never heard of a more elusive Indian, and tracking him had become the most perplexing mystery he'd ever known. Funai contracted anthropologists to try to piece together a speculative tribal description of the Indian based on the scraps of information the contact front had collected. For lack of a better name, they called him the Indian of the Hole, latching on to the one characteristic of his dwellings that set him apart from the other local tribes. The holes found in his huts led some anthropologists and indigenists within Funai to speculate that he might be a remnant of a band of Siriono Indians, a semi-nomadic tribe from Bolivia whose only agricultural tool is a digging stick and whose only weapon is a bow and arrow. In the early 1900s, observers believed the Siriono's culture was one of the world's most primitive. Early Jesuits in Bolivia brought some of them into their missions, but most were dismissed as hopelessly uncivilized. Years later, anthropologists developed a more charitable view of the Siriono culture. It wasn't that the culture was barbarically crude, it was that it had been pushed to the brink of destruction by smallpox, influenza, and the destruction of their territory. Like the Akunsu, the Siriono spoke a language of the Tupi-Guarani root. But the anthropologists and the members of the Contact Front eventually abandoned the idea that the lone Indian might have been the lone remnant of a band of Siriono. No Siriono Indians dug holes inside their huts, as this Indian did. They also used much bigger longbows. And when Altair had confronted the lone Indian in 1996, he tried out a Tupi-Guarani greeting, to which the Indian didn't respond. The Siriono theory was as shaky as any other. The team simply couldn't provide Funai with a tribal affiliation for the Indian without contact. Marcelo urged his bosses to imagine for a moment what must be going through the Indian's mind as they tried to make contact with him. When he summarized the plight of Hondonia's isolated Indians in letters to his bosses, it was clear that Marcelo was referring to one Indian in particular. The first thing that's obvious is that the situation of these Indians is a calamity, a national embarrassment. They've been poisoned, shot at, been decimated, have had their houses and gardens destroyed, and now they're prohibited from living anywhere in peace. Our work also has unquestionably been complicated by the innumerable expulsions from territory that they have been subjected to. We're stuck in an odd situation on account of all this turbulence surrounding local agricultural development. It requires a lot of patience and determination to try to present ourselves as being different than all the other civilized people they've known. The Indians are obviously very distrustful and hide themselves very craftily, making our searches even more difficult. Sidney Posuelo, the head of Funai's Isolated Indians Division in Brasilia, sympathized with Marcelo. Posuelo believed that isolated Indians should remain isolated, and that contact almost always weakened the tribes. But given the speed and extent of the deforestation in Hondonia, Posuelo believed that in this case the lone Indian's death was inevitable. Ranchers or loggers would kill him sooner rather than later. In this case, contact was necessary, and Posuelo encouraged Marcelo and his team to get out into the jungle and keep trekking, which is exactly what they did. Funai gives its Sertanistas an operational manual, a 71-page book of practical advice designed for contact teams preparing to enter the jungle and look for Indians who've never interacted with anyone outside of their tribe. Parts of it read like a locker room pep talk, urging the teams to develop a sense of companionship, solidarity, and esprit de corps. But most of it is flatly practical, full of packing checklists. It issues reminders to take nothing for granted, including the backwoods competence of the Sertanistas themselves. On page 54, would-be explorers learn, "To discover out in the middle of the jungle that one forgot to bring a sewing needle or a disposable hypodermic needle, where there is no longer the possibility of getting them, may produce a passing discomfort or may cause a tragedy." A few pages later, "Watch out for brand new jeans. They usually cause a rash on the inner part of the upper thigh." Marcelo and his team relied more on their own judgment than the advice handed to them from headquarters in Brasilia. They never wore the uniforms that Funai had dreamed up for its Sertanistas, military-like fatigues, Bermudas, and long socks, which were supposed to be instantly recognizable to Indians, so the tribes could distinguish them from ranchers or anyone else. And instead of checking off the 230 items the manual suggested they pack for expeditions, a list that included everything from sunscreen to toothbrushes, they relied more on their own experience. Their limits were defined by their individual backpacks, 75-liter models made of a green canvas that was light enough to collapse well if empty, but sturdy enough to support a maximum of 45 pounds of cargo. Altair and Vincent believed that a law of diminishing returns began to kick in at about 35 pounds. Beyond that, the extra weight wasn't worth the luxury that any additional item might provide. Marcelo's target weight was a little lower. He liked to limit his pack to 25 pounds or less. Hammocks were absolute must-haves for everyone. Theirs were lightweight nylon, weighing about 20 ounces, and they rolled up to about the size of a fat Metropolitan Sunday newspaper. Hammocks are ideal for warm weather, but if the temperatures dipped below about 60 degrees at night, which was common, the cool air penetrated the thin fabric of the hammock's underside and seeped directly into the bones. If they wanted to sleep well on such nights, a thin 6x10 blanket that could wrap completely around the body was key. If it was warmer, all they needed was an ultra-thin cotton sheet. Another necessity was a machete, the most useful tool an explorer could carry in the forest. Pocket knives occupied a slightly lower place in that hierarchy of necessity. Mosquito repellent was generally considered a waste of packing space, while a sheer square of mosquito netting was deemed judicious because it was lighter than a can of repellent, less messy, and more effective. A plastic tarp that could be tied to trees and used as a rain shelter was a smart addition to any pack, but a full tent was excessive. Sewing kits, rope, first aid supplies, and soap were essentials, but squandering space on drinking water was perhaps the worst affront against jungle trek efficiency. Creeks and rivers were easy to find, and the water was clean and cool. An extra pair of shoes or boots was considered an extravagance, but black electrical tape, used to repair shoes and boots, always had a spot in the corner of a pack. Fishing poles were superfluous because the forest provided an inexhaustible supply of cane rods, though fishing line and hooks were well worth their weight. If the expedition was expected to last more than a couple of days, they hauled antiseptic powder and antibiotics, but usually left them behind on shorter journeys. Each of them packed a single change of clothes, an extra t-shirt, socks, and a pair of pants. Towels were optional. Marcelo never packed one, figuring his extra t-shirt worked just as well. A lot of the weight they carried was dry food, such as rice, beans, pasta, sugar, and coffee, about 15 to 20 pounds of it per person for a 2-week hike. Sometimes they carried dried meat, but normally they relied on the forest for their protein. Wild pigs and spider monkeys were the preferred game, but sometimes hunting and slaughtering them didn't make sense. It took about 3 days for 4 people to eat an average-sized spider monkey. That meant they'd be forced to carry the rest of the meat on their backs for at least 2 days. From a packing perspective, killing large animals usually wasn't worth the effort. The operational manual makes it very clear that such matters are anything but trivial, and the obsessive emphasis it places on the finer points of expeditionary preparation seems to reach toward a mild paranoia. Parts of the manual seem to suggest that the Sertanistas not only should be prepared for disaster, but also expect it. When addressing the stress that accompanies first-time encounters between tribes and Sertanistas, the sympathies of the manual's anonymous author at times seem to lie with the explorers, not the Indians. Nobody will ever imagine what moral strength a man needs to dominate the unbearable nervous irritation caused by his feeling himself incessantly besieged, watched, and studied in his smallest acts by people he cannot see, of whom he doesn't even know the numbers, whom he doesn't want to harm or chase away, but rather please and attract, and yet who are just waiting for the right moment to assault and kill. In her 1998 book, Indigenism, Brazilian anthropologist Alcida Rita Ramos spotted what she considered a glaring omission in Funai's Sertanista manual, one that she suggested betrayed the agency's fundamental flaw. Symptomatically, the manual is almost silent about how these teams should or should not behave once they come face to face with the Indians. Pura finished packing for the expedition on the morning of August 1st, digging around inside his hut for a clutch of arrows to take with him. Marcelo, Vincent, and Altair waited with the rest of the Canoe tribe in the clearing outside. Tatua had been nervous for days. She was worried about her son, Pura. She feared that the same bad spirits that had recently sickened her grandson, Opera, might hang over the expedition. Since Owaimoro's death, Pura was more important to the tribe than ever. If anything happened to the group's only adult male, the survival of the Kanoe would be thrown into peril. Marcelo and Altair knelt down close to Tatua and her grandson, whose stomach was aching. They tried to convince her that they'd take good care of Pura during the trip. Altair gently stroked the boy's hair, trying to deflect some of the tension in the air. He looked into the boy's eyes and smiled. Pura emerged from the hut, ready to go. But before the group departed from the village, Tatua motioned to Vincent, asking him to come to her. She wanted to tell him something, and Vincent concentrated on her body language to try to decode her message. She wore an expression of concern on her face as she motioned toward Vincent's midsection. She was clearly worried, but Vincent couldn't understand why. At the same time, Pura grabbed a bite of turtle meat that had been smoking on the fire, a little snack for the road. Vincent, who had fought diarrhea from eating turtle the very first time he'd met the Kanoe, almost 3 years earlier, assumed that Tatua was trying to warn him to be careful of getting sick again. Vincent wasn't one to put much stock in tribal superstitions, and he didn't give Tatua's concern much thought. A few days later, he'd look back on that moment and consider the possibility that the woman might have been referring to something else, that her sixth sense had been picking up the signals of a more serious kind of danger. Then he'd laugh the thought out of his head. He was probably giving her too much credit. Her gesture could have meant anything. Clutching his rifle in his left hand, Altair twisted through a tangle of ferns. It was August, the dry season. It hadn't so much as sprinkled in 60 days, leaving the air grainy with hints of smoke from the fires that charred the tree line miles away. Insects droned within the streaming bars of light that penetrated the forest's canopy. The papery rustle of leaves accompanied each footstep. Marcelo, Vincent, and Pura followed him deeper into the jungle, wiping the sweat out of their eyes as they walked. They'd been hiking for 3 days when they found a lightly trodden path. After following it, Altair spotted a partially concealed pitfall. The loose dirt around it suggested it had been dug within the past 24 hours. While the others inspected the pit, Altair found ground markings indicating that someone had diverged from the path to follow a northeasterly course through the woods. In a patch of soft mud, he found a fresh print from a bare human foot. Altair motioned to Pura to look at the print. Bending down to the ground, Altair placed both hands around the impression to measure it from toe to heel. When he held his hands out to show Pura how big it was, Altair held his hands about 16 inches apart. "He's huge," Altair was trying to tell him. "An absolute monster." Altair was joking. The footprint may have been wider than most, but it wasn't any longer than Pura's own. Pura returned Altair's smile. When Altair joined the others around the pitfall, he found a piece of wood with a broad and sharp point. It was a digging stick, probably the same one the Indian had used to dig the pitfall. Altair held the stick and stabbed it into the dry soil, trying to imagine how the Indian might have created his spike-bottomed trap. Digging a hole like that would take a couple of hours of back-wrenching labor at the very least. They walked on, with Marcelo leading the way, until they spotted a small hut across a tiny clearing. The fronds of the roof weren't dried and browned like those that covered the other huts they'd found. These were green, as if they'd been collected recently. Pura stiffened and motioned to the others. He'd heard something.
"Quiet,"
Marcelo whispered to the group. They stood still and listened. A rustling. It was the Indian. He was near the pitfall they'd just abandoned, perhaps checking it for fallen game. They ran toward him, but he vanished, It was as if he'd found a crack in the deep green curtain of foliage behind him and quietly slipped off stage. Actually, he'd fled toward his hut. He was inside it. They returned to the hut. Altair set his rifle down and approached the structure. "Oye, amigo," Altair said. There was no response, but through a slight gap in the thatch, Altair could see the man's eyes peering at him. Altair turned to the others. "He's there," he said, "standing inside the hut." They couldn't see the Indian, but through the tiny cracks in the thatch, they detected movement. Vincent aimed his video camera at Altair, who was inching closer to the hut. Through the small openings in the wall, he could discern that the Indian was standing up. The men looked at one another for a moment, silently sizing up the situation, trying to figure out how to convince the man to come out of the hut and join them. Altair peeled his t-shirt off, thinking that maybe the Indian would relate to him more easily if he could see that underneath their clothes, these strange men were essentially the same as he. Altair took a few careful steps forward, until he was about 10 feet from the hut. He noticed that something was protruding through the thatch, twisting in place. "Look," Altair said, "an arrow inside." It was just like the one Altair had seen nearly 2 years earlier, during his previous encounter with the Indian. As Altair backpedaled a couple of steps, the tip of the arrow disappeared inside the hut. "Easy," Altair said. "Easy, my friend." Altair again stepped slowly toward the hut, and the arrow again emerged from the thatch. Squinting into the hut, Altair could barely make out the Indian's form. It appeared that he was standing with his bow drawn. Altair slowly backed up, showing the man his palms, meaning no harm. Once again, the arrow disappeared as Altair retreated. It seemed that the Indian was drawing an imaginary line in the dirt about 10 feet around his hut, a line that said, "Keep your distance." "Come on out, amigo," Altair said in Portuguese. "We're not here to hurt you." Marcelo figured that it was time for Pura to try to speak with the Indian. He turned and called for Pura to step forward. Maybe the lone Indian would be calmed by the sight of another tribesman. "Speak to him," Marcelo told Pura. Pura inched toward the hut as if approaching a tensely coiled snake.
"Mampi, no,"
Pura said in the Kanoe tongue.
"Don't shoot."
The Indian inside the hut didn't react. Pura was scared and took several steps backward. Marcelo tugged at the sleeve of Pura's t-shirt, signaling that he'd take his t-shirt off and try again. Maybe the Indian would relate to Pura if he saw that he wasn't dressed in white men's clothes. Pura did so, approaching the hut for the second time, and the arrow popped out of the hut's wall again. This time the arrow emerged with a sudden thrust, as if to emphasize his warning to stay back.
"No, no, no,"
Marcelo said, pleading with the Indian and quickly jumping backward. Marcelo held an upraised palm toward the hut and offered a smile of reassurance.
"Come, come."
The Indian showed no signs of wanting to interact, but Marcelo didn't want to let the opportunity slip out of his hands. After tracking him for 2 years, Marcelo finally had laid eyes on the Indian. He couldn't simply turn around and go home. If he could just break down the man's resistance, everything might fall into place. Funai could officially catalog his tribal affiliation, opening the possibility of permanently preserving his land and reducing the threats to his livelihood. If the man was the last member of a dying tribe, as Marcelo had begun to suspect, then anthropologists could study his culture and linguists could analyze his language before they sank into extinction. No one could guarantee that Marcelo and the rest of the team would ever get a chance for contact this good again. They needed to make the most of it. If Marcelo was nervous, he didn't show it. He figured that if the Indian sensed that he was edgy, things might get dangerous. When Marcelo told the others, "He's still showing me the arrow," his voice had the lilting cadence of a kindergarten teacher who didn't want to excite the kids and who wants to seem as gentle as a lamb. No one moved for a couple of minutes. No one spoke. Birdsong filled the silence.